Let's talk.
John Brown. English, solitaire, cowboy, cuckoo. A bizarre but true autobiography chronicles Mike Leaver's madcap travels and death-defying misadventures as a solo mountaineer. Delighted to say that joining me, not somewhere from halfway up a mountain, but obviously a luxurious bachelor pad, is the author of English, Solitaire, Cowboy, Cuckoo, Mike Leaver. Mike, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, and thank you for inviting me onto your programme.
No problem at all. It's Friday. Why not? Whereabouts are you, by the way? Where do we find you today?
Well, because I don't have electric at home and that sort of stuff, we're in an office called Babby Purr, and they help me out with water and all the things I need to live. And they put me into a Zoom meeting sort of thing, whatever that is, but I'm just talking.
Right, fair enough. Are you
sort
of like an off-grid sort of person then? Are you one of those people, or have you just not paid your bill for a while?
No, nothing at all on that one. Heating is just old pallets and any scrap timbers going around. I don't suppose you get that much problem in Spain.
I used to live off grid myself. So where does it all start then? Where does it all start? Because you're originally from Brum, aren't you?
I am, yes. Do you know the city?
I know it very well indeed, for I am from Stoke-on-Trent, just up the road from you guys. So where does the story start then? As a kid in Birmingham?
Yeah, climbing under bomb sites. I was shortly after the war, and the bomb sites was all there, and that was our playground. So I learned to climb up crumbling walls and, you know, half-demolished houses, and, you know, give me a basic skill. And then because I had asthma, I was taken out of the city and sent to a state boarding school, and there I learned to climb trees.
Right.
I also learned to run away very well in the middle of the night, because they kept caning me for various things. And, things like having an untidy desk. I got caned for that.
Right.
So I didn't appreciate that. So I ran away in the middle of the night. And eventually, they were so hard to keep me in that my mother took me away and went to live at a caravan in Breen, Somerset.
Right.
And I learned to climb on the sea cliffs, the rocks.
What's the fascination with climbing? Why do you think, why the bug? I mean, you're talking to a guy who gets nervous if he goes up three flights of stairs. I get terrible vertigo. I'm fine in planes, but you put me on a multi-story car park or on a cliff and I become jelly. Why don't you get that, my friend Mike?
Because climbing is a natural survival instinct. So all children learn to climb. And basically, they are taught by parents that it's nasty climbing trees, or some parents at least. And if you can climb a tree, you can escape a wolf and not get eaten in the ancient times. And nowadays, it's just a fun thing to do. And, well, I go underground as well. I do potholing.
Oh, you do that as well. So that, you know, you do also not only above ground danger, but below ground danger.
Yes.
So when did you were doing sea cliffs, which must have been interesting. And in the 70s, you did that sort of pan-European camper van or interrailing. I mean, tell us about how you got to Europe.
No, nothing like that at all.
Right.
I started off climbing in Snowdonia. And then I moved up to Scotland for the bigger mountains.
Right.
And the first abroad trip was on a motorbike, which took me as far as the Alps, went to do Mont Blanc. So I didn't quite get to Spain.
The way you say, oh, I just went to do Mont Blanc, what, on your own with kit? How did you? Because, I mean, that's it. What people don't realise is, I mean, Snowdonia and Ben Nevis, and every year we hear of mountain rescue having to get somebody who's trying to go up Ben Nevis in flip-flops because they think it's a theme park. But, you know, Mont Blanc's quite fearsome as well.
Well, I was lovesick and I needed to free the... Well, basically, I took a lady climbing up Ben Nevis. So
that's a hell of a first date, Mark.
It was a first date as well. And after doing this first date, I said, would you like to go and climb Mont Blanc next? Because that seemed, well, I was showing off a little bit, to be honest. I didn't think she'd say yes, but she said yes. So I got really carried away and I built an armchair on the back of the seat at the back of the motorbike so she could have a nice armchair. And I adapted all the motorbike to make her comfort. And she jilted me 3 days before meant to go, and said, not going. So I went to walk around the streets in the rain.
Yeah.
Because that's a good thing to do.
Yeah.
And then I went into the picture house to dry off, and James Bond was on the film, the one where he's skiing down the Alps.
Yep.
But I thought, go anyway. But what have I got to lose? How can I gonna live without this lady of my life?
Is that The Spy Who Loved Me, where he goes off with the parachute and the Union Jack on the parachute?
Yeah, I think it's that sort of one. I just remember that it was the first time I'd ever seen the Alps. And so I just went on my own, and it was quite good fun, most of it. I think it was all good fun. So I had a road atlas.
Yeah.
But when you come to Europe, it comes down to size. So the old France was basically one page, but it had a triangle where Mont Blanc was. So I went down to there.
Right.
The big problem is that they have tolls on the French motorways.
Yes.
Which are really expensive. So I got caught and I didn't have enough money with me. So I had to go around all the back roads. And then I got to Chamonix.
Yep.
Spelled with an X for some reason. And bought a postcard showing me what the mountain looked like.
Right. By the way, just to let you know, Ian's in the. If you can hear some laughing, that's Ian who is with Mike as well. You're not hearing me twice. Morning, Ian. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Lovely.
Right. So there you are with a postcard and a page atlas. Did you have any kit apart from obviously now a broken armchair that you'd smashed into 1,000 pieces in a fit of pique?
No. The armchair was still there.
Oh right. Okay.
The climbing gear on the armchair because they had to extend the chassis of the motorbike to put the climbing gear on.
Right.
So I had a spare chassis at the back. So the rucksacks. Initially, when I went up, I did take all the abseil equipment in case I needed to retreat, basically. But I was so overloaded that I passed out at about 11,500 feet on an ice wall. So
as you do, right? Okay.
Basically, I started from sea level, you see. Well, virtually sea level.
Yeah.
The motorbike would disagree with that because the motorbike did the first 1,000 foot. But went up and passed out, and then I was hanging from an ice axe when I come round, so that was okay. So I got back down, and then I spent a couple of days recovering. It was only altitude sickness.
Oh yeah.
And then the second time when I went back up, I went very light. I just had nothing, basically. No ropes, no retreating equipment. And that's the safest way of doing it because you can move quickly. And abseils, very limited. Escaping from an abseil is not so straightforward as you see. I had some 9-inch nails I could hammer into the ice or rock cracks.
Right.
So I could abseil from there if I needed to. But they're not always in the right place.
Right.
You better keep on going up. Yeah.
I mean, apart from this sort of DIY B&Q attack thing to approach to mountaineering, you said you didn't have ropes. Presumably you had a safety rope because you'd pass out via altitude sickness, or did you discard ropes?
The ice axes have straps on.
Okay.
Wrist straps. So I had about 10 seconds warning before I actually lost consciousness.
Right.
And the straps around my wrists. So when I passed out, I was just hanging on the axes and just resting.
On an ice wall. Did anybody know you were there? Or did anybody say, zut alors, it is the crazy Englishman here again?
Well, no, nobody knew I was there because didn't really know anybody. As a matter of interest, when I arrived on the motorbike, I had to come up a really steep hill. It's a farm track that I thought was I don't know what it was. But at the top, there was an adventure centre with a lot of children in, particularly young girls.
Right.
And because I had to slip the clutch to get up the steep hill, there was sort of 1-in-3 hill, and I had all the gear on the back. So it was quite a heavy motorbike to get up. And of course, they had an armchair on and
yes,
put runner boards on for the ladies' feet and things like that. So I arrived in clouds of smoke and oil burning. Yeah. And all the people, all the children, they just ran out and surrounded me. And of course, it was all French. And none of them could speak English. And there was just one girl who thought of four English words, which was the English solitaire, cowboy, cuckoo. And that's the order in which she said them.
Ah, okay.
And that's where the title of the book comes from. So thank you to the 14-year-old girl.
Right.
Who gave me the title for the book many years later.
So this obviously sparked a thirst for travelling. I mean, obviously Mont Blanc with Nine Inch Nails. You got a truck and you went to just across the water from where I am at the moment to Morocco, and then across one of my favourite bits, which is the Sahara. So describe that route, because was this in the 70s before? Because Morocco now is quite a popular sort of tourist haunt for the boho lot, and in the 60s it was kind of. Sort of.
Well, we're up to 1990. There's quite a bit in between.
Right.
When I got back to England,
yeah,
I joined a mountaineering club and I teamed up with somebody who taught me how to climb with ropes and stuff.
Okay, yeah. Right.
And I did about 3 years quite intensive rock climbing. Then my career got in the way a little bit. And then the houseboat on which I was living sank, so I was homeless for a time.
The houseboat you were living on sank?
Yes, so I was homeless.
Right. Well, iceberg? Nine Inch Nail in the wrong place? How did the house bilge pump break off? What happened?
Well, it was a porter cabin in a steel box, basically.
Right.
And because I didn't have time to finish it off.
Yeah.
I got the steel box bigger than the porter cabin. It just basically filled up with rainwater and sank.
Okay. Yes, I can see the design. Okay. Talk about the way more unusually travel. So okay, so there you are. There's been a slight sort of, you know, there's been a slight break. So when did the Morocco trip happen then?
Well, I moved into a wagon when I was about 40. No, it's about 38. I moved into a lorry.
Yep.
And that was a British Telecom lorry, which was basically for local deliveries and, you know, fixing people's telephones at home or something. So it wasn't a very big one. It wasn't very powerful. And I just put a camp bed in the back. And that was it, basically. That was the motorhome for a time. And I thought when I got to 40,
yeah,
I do need to do something with my life. So I decided to drive to Africa to climb Typical. And the reason why I mentioned all the motorways in France being expensive, I obviously got a phobia about tolls. Don't like paying them, especially in France where you've got all the people in booths and they don't let you through unless you give them loads of money.
Yeah.
Basically, one day hopping in. So I had to go through the back roads, using a compass. It's on a principle, never use the motorways. But when you're going to Africa, you don't go through Paris. It's not the logical thing to do. You sort of come into the thing, the Le Havre, is it on the corner?
Yeah.
Of the...
Yeah, the west, yeah, and then down by Nantes.
Yeah, and then I got to the Pyrenees, which is very, very nice.
Did you think I'd do a bit of quick climbing whilst you're going through the Pyrenees? Just pull the truck to the side and have a quick scale of a mountain or two?
Don't think so. Right. I tried to swim the Atlantic, but it's very cold.
You tried to what? Sorry?
I tried to have a swim in the Atlantic.
Oh, you tried to have a swim. I thought you tried to swim across the Atlantic, knowing you. I mean, I thought that would, you know, with a couple of 6-inch nails for ballast, you know.
Yeah. This was January, by the way.
Ah, right, okay.
So it's...
So you arrive in Morocco, and for those who don't know, Marrakesh, and behind Marrakesh, you have the Atlas. Now, the Atlas are quite something, aren't they?
But can I just compliment Spain on its roads?
You can indeed. Thank you very much.
Because when I was going up trying to get the pass from the High Atlas, it's San Sebastian, I think it comes from, very steep. The top speed of my lorry was about 4 miles an hour, so I had quite a convoy following me. And when I come down the other side, because it was quite a high, you know, bit of a high lorry. I didn't want to capsize it. There to sort of stay with me all the way. And then we got to the Spanish roads and they all overtook me in mass. And all the roads down there are beautiful. And I went down to Madrid.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a very nice city, even to the extent I parked on the outside for a couple of days and had a look around, pretty like the fountains. Then I got to, following a compass, I got to the rocket boat. I thought that's where the boats come from, went from. No, they don't. I can see my thinking head on the Zoom call. So I got directed to the right place.
Algeciras, the beautiful port of Algeciras.
Well, that's what it's called, yes. Yeah. And that's where my road atlas ended, basically. Then it covered Spain. So, but I knew vaguely where it was. But it's just, you know, it's a nice little triangle. But for various complicated reasons, too long to go into on a short interview, I got put on the wrong ferry. So I thought I was going to Tangier. But because I do a lot with compasses, I realised the captain was going to the wrong place.
Right, where did you end up?
It's a
Ceuta. Ceuta.
That's it, yes.
Right.
So I ended there. I didn't have enough money with me to... I had some traveller's checks, but Ceuta, I didn't think I'd cash them. And anyway, I had a few things go wrong in Ceuta. And ended up in jail for a short while.
Oh, as you do. Yeah. Okay. and he hadn't officially left Spain at that point because Ceuta is actually still part of Spain. So you're still not actually in Morocco, Mark.
Yeah. But anyway, eventually you'd come to various agreements and right. I got out. But of course, it's quite a long way to Tangier. But just, you know, because you have to, all the roads go all the way around. I imagine it's march around. And God, this is 1990. Early 1990s.
Right.
So it's probably different now. So there was a lot of people having to pay tolls on the road, as you do that route. But I didn't have any money with me. And the customs guy said, well, all you can do is just keep on driving. If they're across the road, they'll jump out of the way. And they're probably not used to a telecom wagon coming.
Barreling down. Yeah, exactly.
And then I got to Tangier and... then managed to get some money in Tangier, so that was fine. And then I just started heading south. Kept on going, got a bit warmer. Went to Casablanca. After Casablanca, it went really nice.
Mm-hmm.
Palm trees, and then you come to the desert. And that was really good, because that's where I wanted to go to. Well, the edge of the desert, to be honest. But I consider it the Sahara, because there are no plants there, nobody living there. So then I parked up the lorry and I wanted to go swimming in the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a compass bearing to the west because I knew the sea was to the west.
Yeah.
And I walked to go and have a swim in the sea. But, of course, the telecom wagons are yellow, if you know what the telecom wagons are like. And the sand was yellow as well.
Yes.
So basically, going around, I couldn't see the wagon. So I had to just rely on the compass bearing. So that's okay. And I went to do my swim, which is really nice. It's a little bit cold, which is strange when the temperature in the wagon got up to about 40, 50 degrees. It was off the scale because it's got a transparent roof. So all I could do in the daytime was lie underneath the wagon and let the sun go down.
But you see, the thing is, if you're next to the water there, like, people pay an awful lot for that these days as a health treatment, you know, sauna and then cold and then ice bath.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's really. The slight problem is that I went into, obviously, wasn't wearing many clothes, but I took the clothes off to go and have a swim.
Yes.
And I sort of, there's a current apparently or something.
Right.
At the ocean, and I couldn't find my clothes there, not for some time. So I sort of, that was probably quite a vulnerable moment for me because I was standing on a beach miles from anywhere, no clothes, and fortunately, nobody came along to witness the event. And eventually, I obviously found where I left my clothes.
Let's take a trip because we've got a couple of minutes to go. You also, it's not only Atlantic and beaches. I mean, you've been up in the high Arctic, for goodness sake. Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, well, that was a bit later on. That was when I was 46, 47. Again, had a bigger lorry. Certainly, I got to a big lorry. Got a 7.5-ton Mercedes. And just sort of thought, well, I'd always wanted to do the Scandinavian Three Peaks. So I just drove up there. Again, with the road atlas, obviously.
Yeah. Do you have any sort of mountaineering guides when you get there, or you just rock up with your road atlas and go, right, this is the route?
Yeah, especially the postcard, yeah. Get a postcard.
Right.
The highest in Finland, I actually found the hardest, because there's no postcards of it.
Right.
And I found out eventually, so I didn't quite know where it was going, and there's not many roads near there. And it looked to me as the easiest way to do it was to come in from Norway.
Right.
And then to hope I could climb a border fence or get a hole through a border fence. But there was quite a lot of things in the way that was not marked on my road atlas, like marshes and lakes. And
drunken Finns lying in the road.
I had to go over the top of, and then a blizzard come down, and you know, all the interesting stuff. But there was a hole in the border fence, so I did manage to get through into Finland.
All right.
Up to the highest, it's Halti, the highest in Finland. But the summit is basically a flat plateau. It's very hard to find the summit, so I was wandering around there, and then all the snow came, and then when I came back down, it turned to torrential rain, and I probably pushed myself a little bit there to a bit further than was probably what wise. I was crawling. I was about 2 miles from the truck still when I had to go down to a crawl, and then I sort of lay flat on a track. And I thought, well, if this goes on, I'm just going to die of exposure. So somehow I got back to the lorry. And then as soon as I got back into the lorry, I lit the gas stove, and then my survival instinct had said, you had enough air, I just passed out, basically. But I lit the gas stove before I passed out.
Right.
So I come around and in the warmth. But that was it was a very interesting moment.
So
it took me about 3 days before I could recover from that.
Good grief. So the book... What led to the book then? When did you decide to start writing all of this down?
Well, when I was 26 and I come back from Mont Blanc, I was an accountant at that time, and I thought, as soon as I got back to the office after climbing, you know, glaciers and things like that, I thought accountancy is really boring. I want to be a mountaineer, and the only way I could think about being a mountaineer, it was a bit unorthodox. I didn't think they'd take me in a training centre or something. Was to write a book.
So it's unorthodox.
Yeah, that's going to be the understatement of the week on my show thus far, to be honest with you, Mark. I mean, you know, lighting, you know, nude swimming in Morocco, 9-inch nails, hanging. Oh, I just passed out on a glacier because you hang by your wrists from an ice pick. Yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah. So the Mont Blanc thing, I decided to write a book.
Yeah.
I thought it'd be quite quick, actually, but it took about 3 years to get the first draft. We're talking typewriters and correction fluid here. We're not talking on the old thing. But to be honest, it wasn't really, well, it's a bit rubbish, to be honest. It took about 400 pages just to describe the Mont Blanc thing, which in the revised book, when I actually come to write that section, come down to about 80 pages. You've just got the interesting points in there.
Right.
Lose the dribble, which is something you learn to do, because then I had more expeditions, so I could put them all in and short them down. And I'd had a couple of novels published by that time as well. My agent keeps telling me I've got to mention the name of the book for the first one, which was Yeti Seeks Mate.
Yeah. Well, Tinder profile. I don't know. Won't even swipe right on. But go on.
Well, the thing is, after the Mont Blanc thing, after I recovered from my love sickness, I decided to try and get a girlfriend.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, so I put a personal advert in the Mountaineering magazine, or tried to, and they said, sorry, Sex Discrimination Act, we can't accept an advert for a lady. That's the official.
Okay, yeah, right, fair enough.
British Mountaineering Council magazine. So it's sort of
a hotbed of dating setups, that is, I can assure you. My copy will be arriving at about lunchtime.
So I had to think about a headline. So I thought I'd redid the advert and put it as Yeti Seeks Mate. That got the Sex Discrimination Act, and had another one which said would suit Eskimo wishing to broaden her horizons.
Excuse me, I've just lost it on the live on air. It begs the question, did you get any... Hang on, let me get myself together. It begs the question, did you get any reply to that? I mean, you know, and if so, I mean, it must have been quite frightening, I would have thought, if you put...
I was getting better at the writing.
Yes.
So I could do probably... sometimes I'd better 20 replies.
Right.
Because this is a national magazine.
Okay, yes.
So you'd have to do about 150 miles to actually meet somebody. The problem was when I actually met them.
Yes.
Because there was probably thinking of somebody quite heroic who climbs Mont Blanc.
Yeah.
And I turned on my motorbike with an armchair on the back.
Still.
That obviously sort of, he's not very good.
I'm doing my hair, one of them said, did you?
Yeah. Oh, that was one of the worst ones. Because I'd written to her a few times.
Yes.
Sorry, speaking to me at the side.
Yes.
I had a lovely lady, well, Sandy Lovely, on the letter she wrote, and we wrote back a few times. I said, well, we can go rock climbing now. She said, yeah. So I turned up at a doorstep with my motorbike, with the armchair, and Ian keeps telling me I've got to talk about the Yellow Crusher Army. It's one of the old-fashioned ones, the bucket ones.
Yeah.
I had Edwardian clothes on because when I went to Mont Blanc, you see, I bought a mountaineering book to see what we should be wearing, and they were all wearing Edwardian clothes because it was an Edwardian book.
Yes, okay.
It's a famous one. So that was the sort of thing it was. And she just looked at me, she looked at the motorbike, said, I'm sorry, I've got to wash my hair this afternoon and close the door on me. So I've got a thing about... Not looking interested in ladies who need to wash their hair quite a lot.
Well, indeed, I've got some Inuit friends, believe it or not, formerly known as Eskimos, but I call them the Eskimalas because they're quite good fun. I'm going to run out of time. What do you hope? What do you hope that people take from the book, Mike? What do you hope that people learn?
Well, it's done as a because it's me doing it. I've never been to the Himalayas or anything big. Mm. It's done. That anybody normal, normally fit or a normal income can also do my adventures. You don't need a lot of money to do it. Never use hotels. Always sleep in a busy bag when I'm traveling. Well, if I'm going into the mountains, use a busy bag or just sleep in the motorbike. Just sleep in my wagon now. I'd never gone to the really hard climbing, like the North Wall of the Eiger. I've only ever done, quite good at building igloos. Yeah, quite like building igloos. And
Eskimo wishing to broaden her horizons. I come with my own icy hut. The book is called.
I did actually have one Eskimo reply. I didn't make it into the book.
Right,
it was a bit. But she wrote. She was born in Greenland.
Yep.
And she's came across to experience England. I don't know why, because Greenland sounds wonderful. And she was living in Dover. Now, I don't got no idea how she came to be living in Dover, but I had a look at the map and thought, well, that's about 200 miles from where I'm living. It's totally in the wrong direction to any mountains. And even though she might be the most wonderful ladies in the world, you'd have to do 200 miles down, then you'd have to travel 500 miles back up to Scotland where you could build a sensible igloo.
Well, there you go, you see. I'm going to run out of time. The book is called English Solitaire Cowboy Cuckoo. It's by Mike Lever. Mike and Ian, thank you so much for your time today.
No, thank you.